You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Sam. On tonight's program, Liz Olds talks with Richard Barone, a recording artist, performer, producer, professor, and author of Music Plus Revolution, Greenwich Village in the 1960s, for a part two discussion that will take up the full hour. Barone unrolls a freewheeling historical narrative peppered with personal stories and insights from those who were there. Music Plus Revolution celebrates the lasting legacy of a pivotal decade with stories behind the songs that resonate just as strongly today. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Pretty good. We're speaking tonight with Richard Barone, author of Music and Revolution. We had such a good time last week that we decided to have him on again this week. Welcome to Right On Radio again.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me again. Great. How are your holidays going?
Oh, they're going great. They're going great. What about you?
Good. Very good.
Oh, that's good.
Good time of the year, but cold, of course.
Yes. It's been very cold here, too.
Yes.
Music and Revolution, for the sake of people who might not have been tuned in last week, why don't you tell us a little bit about what the book is about?
Well, it's about Greenwich Village in the 1960s, and it's something I've been wanting to write. It's a book I've been wanting to write for a long time, but I am a musician, and I go on the road, and I also teach. I'm a professor of music at the New School here in Manhattan. So writing a book was difficult time-wise for me to do until the pandemic. And that time, that period, from 2020 to 2021, really gave me a chance to put a lot of thoughts together about folk music, about the folk musicians who I have met in my life and what they taught me, and the stories of this neighborhood that I happen to live in, where many of them lived. Going back to the 1940s, you know, this was a folk mecca in many ways. I know other cities around the country and in Canada and other places had folk centers, but Greenwich Village, I felt, and I feel, you know, had a certain, maybe just the numbers of folk singers per square inch, you know, there were just so many. It was so much just on these blocks where I live, so many musicians lived. So I had to write this book as a musician. The stories were just, they were flowing in through me, you know, when I played the songs. And I wanted to write them in a story form.
What do you think drew the youth to Greenwich Village in the first place? It was young people who started this all off, correct? For the most part.
It really was. I mean, and you know, young is a word that can be, you know, it means a lot of things. Young can be someone who's in their 80s, 90s, whatever, too. But yes, like even Pete Seeger, when he first started really teaching and playing folk music, he was in his teens, he was 18 or so, working for the Lomaxes, John and Alan Lomax, who were collecting folk music. And Pete Seeger worked for them as an archivist and helper. And through the Lomaxes, who were also, Alan Lomax was also quite young. I think he was also 18 or 19 years old, the son of John Lomax. And they were hired by the Library of Congress to collect folk music. So this is going back to the beginning. This is where my book starts, really, is this idea of finding folk music and then bringing it into the urban, bringing it into the modern world. And Pete Seeger was a strong believer in the power of folk music, as was Alan Lomax. And through the Lomaxes, Pete Seeger met Leadbelly and Woody Guthrie. And that's really, in a way, where this book starts, even though that's certainly not the 1960s, that's the 40s. The first chapter deals with this era that is the first wave of the folk revival.
Let's talk about Harry Smith.
Talk
about his anthology. I've always been curious. I know kind of why he did it and how he did it, but I'm wondering how it became so popular among people.
So popular. And, you know, I interviewed about 80 people for this book. I did over 80 interviews, and some were multiple of the same person, but certainly a lot of people. And almost all of them mentioned the Harry Smith anthology as being like their go-to. It, you know, let me rewind a moment. There's a big difference between what Alan Lomax was doing with his father. They were collecting music from people's backyards and front porches. And the fields, they were going into fields and they were going into prisons. That's where they found their material that they then put on recordings through the Library of Congress, and people learned and heard the music. With Harry Smith, he was a filmmaker, an independent filmmaker, and also a music fan who collected records, actual recordings. So the Harry Smith anthology, I think in the book I refer to it as like these were ready-made, ready-to-serve songs that people could go perform. The Lomax recordings are field recordings, and you got raw material. But when the Harry Smith box set, which came out in the mid, I believe it was, oh, I don't have the year in front of me, but I would say the early 1950s, maybe 53 or so, that rings a bell. I think that those were finished recordings. Those were already arranged performances that you could then, that people could emulate and copy and play on the stage. So a lot of artists like Dave Van Ronk and, Peter Stanfill, who was in the Holy Modal Rounders, this is where they got their source material to perform on stage, often was the Harry Smith collection, because the songs were edited, arranged, and ready to serve, like I said, to the modern audience of the 1960s. You know, it was a very great collection. I think there are 80 songs on it, 81 or so. And Dave Van Ronk, his claims he learned every single one of them and performed them, you know.
You know, just kind of off top here for a second, there has come out now all the B-sides. They're on a collection of all the B-sides of those things. It's really
so great.
Kind of amazing. Yes, it really brings it all back.
And so one more thing is, I just want to mention the year also, that those were songs from the 1920s and 30s. For listeners that may not know, the Harry Smith anthology, I think most of the songs are from the 1920s and 30s. So it's interesting how those styles then transplanted themselves into the 60s, like the jug band sound, and sounds that had been popular in the 20s were now 40 years later becoming popular again through that anthology.
Now, I have a kind of compare and contrast question, which has to do some with controversy.
Sure.
There was the Kingston Trio, who kind of were very popular and kind of helped bring the folk music back after the loss of it, after the blacklist. And then there's the New Lost City Ramblers, who used Harry Smith a lot. And I'm wondering... See, there was controversy about both of these groups.
Mm-hmm.
You write about that. And I'm wondering also if you could compare and contrast, and also maybe compare and contrast the people who were listening to those folks.
That's such a good question. You're so smart, and you really understand folk music to ask me that. You know, there was a huge difference, and yet there wasn't. It's very complicated, because the Kingston Trio were a very commercial trio. Of fellas called it, you know, very collegiate fraternity boy looking, I mean, just visually, characters from the on the West Coast. The New Lost City Ramblers on the East Coast were scholars, I think, maybe more seriously minded scholars of folk music. Let's put it that way. I think it seems like, in watching videos, and I watched a lot of videos of these groups while I was writing, you know, the Kingston Trio had the air, let's put it this way, not to criticize, because really they were good. And people, even, you know, most people, like, say, Bob Dylan, they all liked the Kingston Trio as well. Many of them, not all. The controversy came with the purists of folk music, who felt that the Kingston Trio were kind of popularizing it, but not really taking it seriously and not taking the songs or the original artists seriously. And certainly in some ways, they didn't, in that they didn't, they often did not even credit the original songwriters, the folk writers who wrote the songs. That's a real serious issue for me as a musician, is people not being credited properly. I just think that's a shame and it shouldn't happen. Even Pete Seeger, who had written Where Have All the Flowers Gone, when the Kingston Trio first were getting ready to release their version of it, they had their own names as the writers. Luckily, Pete Seeger told me this. And when I did the research later after he passed, I found the whole story. And yes, it was ready to print on the record label that that song, Where Have All the Flowers Gone, was written by the Kingston Trio. Now they knew that they didn't write it because they saw Peter, Paul, and Mary sing it. So when you see somebody already sing it, you know that you didn't write it because someone else is already singing it. So someone at the record company or the publisher, whoever was in charge, noticed this mistake and called Pete Seeger and told him about it and said, Pete, this band is doing your song. They put their name on it as the writers. And Pete had his whoever attorney or somebody, or whoever was helping him, called them and corrected before it went to print. So all of the copies that were actually sent to the public had the name Pete Seeger as the writer of that song. But it was a close call and another example of how people would steal songs. And it's sad. Kingston Trio had done that many times and had to go to court many times over songs that they took credit for. Sometimes maybe the 1920s or 30s or old songs may have seemed like that was an eternity ago, but the songwriters were still alive in many cases. Where on the other hand, the Lost City Ramblers, right? The New Lost City Ramblers, they were very, I think, diligent in presenting the songs and telling who wrote it and actually bringing some people, certainly Elizabeth Cotton, onto the stage with them to perform their songs. They were very much archivists. And Pete Seeger's brother, Mike Seeger, was a member of that group. So that lineage and that heritage was there to preserve folk music. But they were criticized for singing in the accents of the South, for instance. Mm-hmm. And that's, it is interesting when you listen to them and they sound so Southern and really they're all from New York City. It was a little, some people criticized them for putting on false voices and false presentation that might've misled people. But as I wrote in my book, they also preserved the music. So yes, they did it in that, they may have done it in a style that was not authentic to who they were, but they did save the music and they presented it, I think, in a very good way. So they're very different, the Kingston Trio, very different groups. I wrote in the book how they both ended up at that first Newport Folk Festival of 1959. They both were there on the stage, you know, just doing their thing. And so both were accepted by the mass public, I think. Certainly the Kingston Trio sold a lot more records. And they had number one hits with, Tom Dooley and certainly big hits with Where Have All the Flowers Gone and other songs. They did a good job with their arrangements, but very slick in comparison to the New Lost City Ramblers.
Talk some about, it seems in your book, like Harry Belafonte had a big role in bringing this music to people. Talk a little bit about him. Hello?
You're freezing up there a little bit. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah,
you froze up there a minute. Good, good. I did hear your question about Harry Belafonte. Such an interesting character. And such a great survivor of the blacklisting, because he was certainly blacklisted right away. He's on that, I believe, the first blacklist that came out. And yet his talent couldn't be denied. He was an all-around performer. He was great on television and radio, and his records were were played so frequently. And he had the first million-selling record of any genre with his Calypso album. It's called Calypso, I think it was the title. And he also was a believer, like Pete Seeger, in the power of folk music to change things. Even his Calypso songs, even the simplest, even a song like the Banana Boat song, is really a political statement about workers, the treatment of workers and classes of people. And you know, there was a statement in there. There was a message in that music that people, as they sang along, maybe it slowly infiltrated like what it was really about, you know, as well as being a pop song that you could sing along to. But he believed in folk music so much, he promoted acts like Odetta, for instance, who was presented in the maybe to her biggest, her first really large audience on his television special that he did. That might have been 1960 or 1959-60, right at the beginning of that decade, was the Harry Belafonte special, which featured folk music throughout, all kinds of folk music. A lot of slave songs and a lot of songs from that the post-Civil War era as well, and presented Odetta. And I think he really kept the flame of folk music alive between that, you know, when I talk about the, you both of us have talked about the two waves of the folk revival. And Belafonte was one of the artists, handful of artists, who kept the flame alive between those two waves where the Blacklist had almost squashed the folk movement. You know, and he brought. May I add too? When Dr. King, had his march on Washington, it's Harry Belafonte who brought so many of the New York Greenwich Village folk singers to perform there, including Odetta, and Peter Paul and Mary, and Bob Dylan, and others. He sort of curated the music for the March on Washington, in which. Dr. King gave his famous I had a dream speech. That event also showed the public the power of folk music. So that was Belafonte not only believing, but showing others and making others believe too, you know?
Speaking of, well, let's talk about Peter, Paul, and Mary a little bit in the context of camp. When I was 11, I went to camp and we sang Peter, Paul, and Mary songs. And
yeah.
Some of the musicians there were so good. They were singing things like the Great Mandela and stuff like that.
Wow.
I mean, we were very, very into the politics of it. And I'm wondering if you could talk about camp and how camp influenced. Peter, Paul, Mary influenced camp and vice versa.
Oh, wow. And Pete Seeger songs, too, which, you know, the camps, summer camps, you know, this is where people heard. This is where folk music lived throughout Blacklisting or anywhere. There was nothing you could touch camps, you know. When we mentioned Where Have All the Flowers Gone, that song was a super top favorite at camps. And some of the lyrics were actually added, and I don't have the name right in front of me, but it's in the book. Some of the lyrics were added by a camp leader. Did you know that? On Where Have All the Flowers Gone? Yeah, check it out. Yes, so Pete Seeger had maybe three or four verses, but you know how it wraps around and that the lyrics then, so where have all the flowers gone? Or where have all the soldiers gone? Where have all the graveyards gone? And it has a full circle. The lyric comes back to flowers again at the end. That was added by a camp leader. And Pete loved it so much that he made that part of the official lyrics and credits that camp leader as his co-writer on the song, which I think is beautiful, you know, and it's something that came out of singing it, that this camp leader leading the songs added verses to round out the lyrics so that it's a full circle. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's part of the folk process.
Yes. So
exactly.
That's a really fair example of the folk process. Like what I was talking about before, where people just slap their name on as the writer. That is not the folk process, but that happens so much. And as you know, for my book, there's a lot of references to songs. I say, look, I'm sorry, but that was actually written by, you know, I found the folk singer who first did it, and later a famous person may have their name on it, but it's not actually written by them. Well, that's a bad version of the folk process, I think. The good way is when you add to it lovingly and graciously, and, you know, often with permission to alter the song and to certainly taking old songs and adding to them is a big part of the folk process. It's just, my beef is when people take credit for songs from contemporary writers or, you know, more current writers and just take it, you know, I think that's then, and they say it's the folk process. That's a misuse of that word. Your use of it is correct. You know, yes, the camp leader wanted to add more verses. And so he added more, and Pete loved it. And that's a beautiful example of the folk process, I think, you know?
A lot of the blues guys were stolen from too, correct?
Yeah, a lot of them, you know. Even groups like, you know, it's famously a group like Led Zeppelin, who I like the way they play and everything, but they were, you know, taking from blues singers left and right. And sometimes it's more than awkward. It's, you know, I really see it. I can see where they, I think Gallows Pole is a song they did really well with Led Zeppelin, but it's really a Lead Belly song, you know, and they don't always credit. I'm not sure if that, when that record first came out. Now then later, as years go by, I mean, the estates of certain writers will go back and say, wait a minute, that's actually written by Lead Belly or Muddy Waters or whoever it is. But when it was first released, it wasn't properly credited. And I just think it's just so wrong and sad that they would just take something without crediting it. But certainly the blues were so easy, like easy picking, because all guitar players, they pick up a guitar and it's so much fun to play blues licks and songs. But you know, you got to give credit where credit is due, and it's certainly due with the creator of the song.
Talk a little bit, compare blues and folk. I mean, they are together, and yet some they're separate. Kind of compare the two.
It's really a blur there, because I think it's a Muddy Waters records. It's called The Real Folk Blues. Like, he puts it all together. He says he's folk blues. So it can be the same. And, you know, that's an ongoing and unanswerable, I think, question, because I think blues is folk music. That's what I think. I think a lot of the music that we play and love is actually folk music. You know, a lot of, I think, pure rock and roll sometimes is actually folk music. But I think certain musicians have the tag of blues. They play in a style that they call the blues, and so their music may be called blues, but I think it's still folk music. And Lead Belly is, some people call him a blues guitar player, a blues singer, but really, he was the epitome of a folk singer, you know? And so I think it's impossible to really answer which is which. I talked to Roseanne Cash, who I loved, and we had the same question about country music. Like, what is country music and what is folk music? What's the difference there? And it, you know, the answer from her was just as confusing as my answer is. We were like, well, you know, she said, well, all folk music is country music. And I said, yeah, but isn't all country music then folk music? And it's just hard to, I'm not good about genres, because I love so many kinds of music myself. And I just love music, and I hate to categorize them. For me, folk music is the wider umbrella. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, I can only speak for myself on this. To me, blues and country fall under the category of types of folk music. That's just how I see it. And I teach this, and I tell my students, look, you don't have to take my word for it, but for me, they fall under the umbrella of folk music. They come from that same source. In the book, I call it the primordial soup. You know, it's like, it's a mindset. It's a music that comes from the people, and they're telling their stories, and they're making their views heard. And that is, to me, folk music. And then if they have a little bit of a different accent, it could be blues, or a little different accent, it could be country, but it's still folk music in my mind.
How did folk rock then come around? I mean, I think about Simon and Garfunkel, and I think about others, you know.
Yes.
I mean, how did it happen, you know?
Yeah, it happened from folk singers. It happened from folk music, because Simon and Garfunkel were a folk duo. You know, pretty pure, just two guitars and, you know, a little other instrumentation and maybe a little banjo here and there. I mean, that was like folk music. And for instance, the Byrds in the West Coast are so highly credited for creating in some people's minds, folk rock. That's not true, by the way. But they were folk singers. And McGuinn, Roger McGuinn, when he was in the Byrds, but Jim McGuinn, when he was playing on the folk scene, you know, he played with the Limelighters, I believe, and he was on the folk circuit as even as a solo guitarist, banjoist, you know, here in the village playing at the Gaslight. So he was playing folk music. He happened to like the Beatles. And he was playing McGuinn, just as one example. McGuinn, Roger, Jim, I'll say McGuinn because he was Jim, became Roger, who changed his name. But Jim McGuinn / Roger McGuinn was performing at the Gaslight, and they had a sign outside saying he's playing a tribute to the Beatles because he was playing Beatles songs in the folk way, right? Hmm. Yeah. And so he couldn't really catch fire as a solo performer in New York somehow. He had been a sideman, had played with, I believe he had played with the New Journeymen, who were then, they morphed into the Mamas and the Papas. The Journeymen were folk. I mean, real folk music. So he was a folk artist. He happened to like the Beatles and got an electric guitar. But he says in interviews, and I researched a lot of interviews with him from that time, he was playing guitar, the 12-string electric, like a banjo. He was trying to play like Pete Seeger, but on a 12-string electric guitar. And that's a lot of the bird sound that you can hear on their second hit was Turn, Turn, Turn by Pete Seeger. And he's playing his electric guitar like a banjo, trying to pick out the notes the way that the banjo would. Next time you hear it, listen, that is truly folk rock. I mean, this is coming from a person who loves folk music, who happens to also like the electric guitar. There's so many cool stories and many in the book about how folk rock emerges, right sort of in the middle of the book. But, mm-hmm. you know, one simple and beautiful story was Simon and Garfunkel. With their songs, The Sound of Silence, which is also Sounds of Silence. There's two different ways to say that title. But they had an acoustic song, just two acoustic guitars, maybe a third, one acoustic guitar and a second guitar played by Barry Kornfeld, who was like picking, like more of a picker, and maybe Paul Simon more of a strummer. You know what I mean? So they had a beautiful song. It didn't do anything. The record did not sell well. And the duo of Simon and Garfunkel broke up. Garfunkel went back to school in Columbia University to study mathematics. And Paul Simon went off to England to try to make it as a solo artist. But while they were away, their producer on the track, Tom Wilson, one of the names like we talked about last week, who's rarely mentioned, but was a great fine producer who produced so many folk albums for an African-American, also a jazz artist who produced many great folk albums. He had this idea, well, if the birds are having this success with electric folk music, maybe we could add some electric instrumentation to a Simon and Garfunkel song. He had been wanting to do this with Bob Dylan also, who we also produced. So that one song, Sound of Silence, had some radio play in Florida on a college station. So Tom went to his superiors at Columbia Records and said, look, this song is getting some radio play. Maybe we should make like a new version of it and, you know, see if we can go further. So after a Bob Dylan session, I believe the song was for Like a Rolling Stone, he withheld some of the musicians and said, look, can you guys stay a little later because we want to try something out. So he had those electric players play along to the original track of The Sound of Silence. So they made a record, and it went to number one. And mm-hmm. it was simply the acoustic track done as it originally was, but just adding some drums, which the drummer, by the way, had a hard time playing along because when acoustic players are playing, they don't always keep a perfect tempo. I don't know. I know you're a banjo player. I don't know about you, but I speed up or slow down or whatever the feeling, wherever my feeling takes me. And that's how Simon and Garfunkel played it. So the band that had to play along to that recording had to move along with the band, if you know what I mean. Had to move along with Peter, with Paul and Art and the way they sang it and played it. So they did. They made a record. But if you really listen, you can hear the struggle. Sometimes I play for my students and they say, Professor, is that right? Like they can tell they're kind of, the drummer's trying to catch up. But it's a beautiful record anyway, I think. Regardless of that that those flaws where they're trying to, you know, match the tempos. It's a beautiful record, and it went to number one. By the time it was used in the movie The Graduate, Simon and Garfunkel were like household names, you know. But that was the beginning of folk rock. It was, at first, it was a difficult birth because, you know, they're trying to merge styles that were different. They're trying to add electric instruments to pre-recorded acoustic tracks. So that's how it started. But when those records came out, okay, The Birds, Turn, 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 and Mr. Tambourine Man, and then Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel's Sounds of Silence with those overdubs, that folk rock was born. And it was a big explosion of sound and ideas, because what really great idea to have commercial music also be great and not be corny and be about good topics, interesting topics, you know? And of course, to end that story though, Paul Simon came home from England and Art Garfunkel left Columbia University and they became Simon and Garfunkel again.
Now isn't there a good story about the Mr. Tambourine Man, or is it Turn, 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 where the Birds didn't like that song originally? And
well, they thought, yeah, it's Mr. Tambourine Man. I think you can never argue with a Pete Seeger song. Turn, Turn, Turn was a work of art. I think they just were so thrilled to be able to record it. And on that record, the Birds actually played their own instruments. On Mr. Tambourine Man, their first single, they had other musicians play for them. Did you know that? Only McGuinn plays. Like the rest of the Birds didn't even play on Mr. Tambourine Man. That was the Wrecking Crew, the musicians in the LA.
In LA.
I think it's Carol Kay on bass. And, you know, that was like the LA musicians because they weren't sure if that band could actually pull it off, you know, to make a hit record. On Turn, 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 it is the band, the Birds. But Mr. Tambourine Man was not really written in 4/4. Like it wasn't in a rock, you know, we say folk rock. Well, it wasn't rock. It was like in a folk waltz. I believe it was 3/4, like 3/4 time, you know. Excuse me. Sorry. So the band had to revise it to make it more sort of straightforward sounding, less of the waltz in the way that Dylan wrote it. So, but Dylan came by the session and heard it and really liked it. And when he heard it and liked it, the band suddenly were happy with it. But at first they were also concerned that they had changed it. They also only used one verse of Mr. Tambourine Man. I mean, Dylan wrote like, I think there are 4 or 6 verses.
Mm-hmm.
I had to sing that last year around this time in New York at a concert. And I was surprised. I was like, okay, I was learning the song. Then I realized, well, I don't need to because they're doing the Birds version. It's only one verse, you know, because usually Dylan songs, as you know, have multiple verses, but they only use one. They use a chorus and a verse and a chorus, I think, and that's it. Very interesting. But yeah, at first they weren't sure about it because they were like, we can't really get a groove on this. You know, it wasn't in a rock tempo, a rock time signature, but then they adjusted it.
You know, it's kind of funny, speaking of sort of folk rock, Peter Tork was a folk musician who ended up in the Monkees, and even Stephen Stills, he tried out for the Monkees, and he was sort of a folk rock person. So the Monkees, if I may, actually had some folk music stuff going on in there.
Absolutely. Really, Mike Nesmith wrote some nice folk rock kind of songs.
That's right. That's right.
And he's a real musician, guitar player. He was an actual musician. Some of them were actors. I really like them. I met the Monkees when I was a teenager. I met Davey and Mickey on tour. That's how I got to New York, ironically, is because I met the Monkees, Davey and Mickey. They were on tour just as a duo with a backing band. And it just so happened that the backing band were New Yorkers who I had seen in magazines. They were called the Laughing Dogs. And they were playing in New York. And I met them. And pretty soon I got invited on the rest of the tour. I was in high school, but it was summer. And I hung out with them. And then I just blurted out, hey, I'd like to go to New York sometime. And the backing band said, hey, why don't you stay in our loft? We're on tour all year. And that's how I got myself to New York. And a place to stay was through the Monkees. So I always loved the Monkees and that connection. And Peter Tork was very close with the Love and Spoonful. And he was in that crowd, which were folk rock, with folkies, really. I mean, John Sebastian was a folk musician from the beginning. His dad was a harmonica player, and John Sebastian is a brilliant musician on many different instruments, but definitely from the folk music world. They lived right on Washington Square Park, where all that folk music was played in the park. So Sebastian, who started the Love and Spoonful, was definitely coming from that place. One of their friends was Peter Tork here in New York. And did you know that the Monkees were based on the Love and Spoonful?
No, I did not know that.
The Monkees were, they wanted, the TV producers wanted the Love and Spoonful. But when you're making a TV show, the discipline required to be at that set at the right hour of day, every day when you're filming, they were not sure. I believe this is what happened. So I'm paraphrasing the history, but I believe that the television producers weren't sure about getting a real rock band, rock and roll folk band to come and do a TV show. And to be actors, to be able to do the drama part of it, you know, and the storyline part of it. So they looked for musicians that looked like the Love and Spoonful. So Peter Tork fit right in. He was a friend of theirs from New York City, lived in the Village, and was ready to go. So he was like the most, he was the most what they were looking for, you know, kind of fun-loving folk rock musicians, you know? And so the Monkees were based on that. Yeah, that's what, if you look at the Love and Spoonful, watch them on television clips, you can see the Monkees in them.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Cool. Say, I just want to let people know, we usually do a calendar around this time, but there are no events for the calendar because I assume it's because it's the week between Christmas and New Year's, and there are no events. So we won't be doing a calendar. We'll just keep talking with Richard Barone, author of the author of the book Music and Revolution.
I would love for it to be a movie, by the way. I think it is a movie. I really think this story is a movie. And I think, you know, that's where I'd love for this to be at some point. It's a movie with actors playing the parts of these great characters because they're so good. They're so fascinating.
Yeah, it really is a fascinating book, I have to say.
Thank you. Thank you.
One thing, you mentioned Carol Kaye, you mentioned Odetta. I know Carol Kaye is kind of a California musician, but a member of the Wrecking Crew. And I mean, if you would be so kind as to talk about women in that folk music world, how difficult it must have been, how there's so many. I mean, I think when people think of women in folk music, you know, it's Joni Mitchell, maybe Mary Travers. Some people know about Buffy St. Marie, but there's so many more.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could talk about the more.
Well, you know, there's so many. And, you know, those, just the ones you mentioned, Buffy St. Marie, to me, should be seen in the same light as Bob Dylan or whoever else is celebrated, because she was a pioneer, a Native American, Native American, Canadian, but Native American, you know, Native North American, indigenous person. She says Indian too, still, because that's the way it used to be, and that's okay for her. But you know, sometimes it's not that they, like, you can mention a lot of women who are there, but they're not, sometimes I feel, not given the name recognition by the media or the recognition as far as their importance that they should be receiving. Let's go back to even before Carolyn Hester. I mean, the woman, you know, there are so many women who were coming up in the first folk revival that were coming up, who were, I mean, without them, it would not have happened. You know, but let's just take Carolyn Hester for a minute. She bridged the 50s and 60s by being, I'm not sure if we mentioned it last time, but she was from Texas, but came into New York around the same time that Buddy Holly, who was her friend, came to New York and lived in the Village. And she for a moment was seen as maybe the bright new hope for the folk music and was on magazine covers. Sadly, and she was singing folk songs, by the way. She wasn't really writing songs. She was singing folk songs. Somehow, when the new wave of songwriters, folk singers came in that were writing their own songs, they kind of wiped out a lot of the past. And some of the names got lost, maybe because of that purge of where the singer-songwriters took over from folk singers. Okay, that's one thought. But at that exact time, Buffy St. Marie came into town, and she was writing songs, but was not very comfortable with being a song or telling people she was a songwriter, because the folk community wasn't really ready yet for having original material being performed. And she told me that she had a hard time being accepted and getting gigs because she wanted to do her original material. You know, she wrote so many great songs, but Universal Soldier is the first one that I learned because of the cover version that Donovan did. But she did it, of course, first, and did an amazing version of it. There was a woman, Alex Dobkin, who we don't hear about, who was very important in the early, in that scene in the early 60s when the folk revival was picking up steam again. One of my favorite singers who was a true folk singer was Karen Dalton. And do you know, are you familiar with Karen Dalton? Do you know her?
I've heard the name. I don't.
Well, check out her singing. Check out her music and her singing style, because she was almost like, you know, like channeling like the blues, like jazz singers, like a Billie Holiday, but doing it with folk music. She had this beautiful expressionistic way of singing, not atypical, not the normal way, just more like a Billie Holiday. I believe, and I don't know this, I've never really studied much about Janis Joplin, even though I love Janis, but I would bet that Janis Joplin heard Karen Dalton. Because a lot of the kind of blues, and I called it scorched earth sound in the book, you know, that she sings with such emotion. She should be a household name. She was a favorite of people that were people, I hate to say again, Bob Dylan, but you know, he's a name people know, but he was a big fan of hers. She had a lot of fans in the inner circle of folk singers, Karen Dalton. There's a new documentary that came out in 2022 about her that I happened to see at a small theater here in New York at the Film Forum, which is like for independent cinema, but it's worth seeking out, the Karen Dalton movie documentary. It's very, very good. Those are just a few.
And would you say it was difficult in the "you play pretty girl, pretty good for a girl" kind of sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was a boys' club, unfortunately. I think it was a heterosexual, macho boys' club. It's sad to say because I love folk music so much. But I'm talking from the point of view of from now, from 2022, when we have more gender. We have all kinds of variations of personalities. We don't have to be stuck in one role, you know what I mean, now. And I think looking at it from the view, from a lens of 2022, it was a very alpha male, macho boys club. It's sad for me to say that. It makes me sad, you know, and I think a lot of the gay men who were folk singers, like Paul Clayton, they were totally pushed aside because this big macho boys pushed them away, you know, and they made fun of them. They still stole their songs and stole the ideas, but they pushed them aside, so we don't know their names now. The historians don't care to write about them, it seems. You know, that's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book. It's also to reveal some of the names that are lost to history. And also, I wanted to write from the point of view, like you, a musician who loves the music and you play the music, you learn it to love it from the inside out. Like you become part of the music. I think so many books are written from the point of view of like, well, who's famous? Let's just drop some names here.
Right.
You know what I mean? So when I was starting to write this book, I had been wanting to write it for years. And the publisher came to me. I was doing a concert of this music. I was playing songs from the early 60s Greenwich Village scene. And my book publisher came to me and said, look, why don't you write a book about it? When I told Donovan, who was my friend, who was an observer of the Greenwich Village scene, but he was watching from England and Scotland where he lived, but loved the music. And played his own folk music and became famous in his own right. He told me, Ricardo, he always calls me Ricardo, never has ever called me Richard. Ricardo, you should write about the names that nobody's heard about. That's where the story really is. And he was so right, because that's how I got a richer story from the musicians who played on the records and from the people and writing and studying and you know, researching about the ones who we don't really hear about very much, like Paul Clayton, like Carolyn Hester, like Karen Dalton, like these, there are a lot of them. And they are the ones, and I tell my students this, they're the ones who really pushed the story forward. They pushed history. They changed, they brought the material out. They were believers in folk music. They're like evangelism for folk music is what really made the others catch fire. And that's why we have these famous ones. Even Joan Baez, she probably, we don't know, I don't know exactly what she listened to, but she must have heard Carolyn Hester, because Carolyn was a few years ahead of her and played at these venues where in Boston, in the Cambridge area. So, you know, I wanted to shine just as much a light on those people as the stars.
Well, you mentioned Alex Dobkin. She was a big starter of women's music.
I know. I know. That must have been
living
hard.
With lesbians. Living with Lesbians, I think, was her first record. And it was the first record before Mae Christian, before Chris Williamson, before any of them. Alex Dobkin was there.
I know. And I think she needs to be celebrated for that, too. You know, that's a whole book unto itself. Is the I came into, when I came to New York, I was playing. I'm not a woman, but I was embraced by, I don't know if you knew a group, the Deadly Nightshade. Did you know them? They were a women's trio, and Helen Hook, the fiddle player in that group, was going solo, and she needed to get a band together. They were playing at Folk City, perfectly enough that they were playing at Folk City, Gertie's Folk City, and she was looking for a band, and somehow came across me and my band I was just forming called the Bongos. And she said, would you guys be my backing band? And we said, yes, we love you. We'd love to be your backing band. Now, the only problem, we've had a great time and it was a musical so much excitement to play with her. But the audiences were not really ready for her having an all-boy band behind her. But we had so much fun and we learned so much from her. She produced our first demo and that's how we got signed to RCA Records. But so but anyway, the women's movement did, you know, catch on after, but in the 60s, it must've been hard for Alex Dobkin. And she was married to a guy. She was married to the owner or manager. I'm not sure if the complete owner of the Gaslight. So she was, she was very connected to the folks. But then she, you know, she said, look, I'm lesbian. She came out early on and that was a very important step. But you know, pre-Stonewall, it was like, they were just, it was really, must have been really hard. I wasn't there, so I can't say for sure, but how can it not have been very difficult for Alex Dobkin? Certainly it was hard for Paul Clayton as a guy also. He could not come out. And if he could have, if only he could have, Paul Clayton and Alex Dobkin, if only they could have been out earlier, I think it would have moved society forward. It could have changed things and they could have become more household names because they would have been free to express themselves with their music. Instead of, Paul Clayton was very extremely closeted and people said, oh, he wasn't a very good performer. Well, maybe if he could have been out, he could have been a good performer.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Yes, and now that we've gotten to the revolution part of the book, I think. We've got about 5, maybe 7 minutes left.
Oh, wow.
Why don't you talk about, I know it's gone by so fast.
Oh, my God.
Why don't you talk about the revolution part of the book?
Well, you know, for me, the revolution is the probably the most important driving force through the book. It's because from the very beginning, folk music was seen as a way to get a message out. That's what I mean. What a shame that the LGBTQ artists could not get their message out. That's what a shame, because from the very beginning, folk music had a message, whether it was about labor unions or civil rights, anti-war. That starts when the early part of the book. That's why they were blacklisted. They were speaking out, you know? So there's a step-by-step revolution through this book. It's funny, when I hear the word revolution, I think of the Trotskyism, which I didn't even know what it was until I was taught by Dave Van Ronk's wife, Terry Thal. Dave Van Ronk was a Trotskyist who believed in perpetual revolution, meaning there's always something to fight about. There's always something to fight for, always. So the revolution does not actually end. You have to stay with it. That's why Dave Van Ronk was in the front lines at the Stonewall riots, because he believed in perpetual revolution. We have to fight or we're going to be stomped over by whatever the word, and maybe at the time it would have been the establishment. You know what I mean? Like, we have to always be on guard. Let's put it that way. Folk music was a way for musicians to express that in music, and also finding ways to write great music that happened to also have a strong, important message. You know what was exciting for me recently, very recently, the last few weeks, was that my school professors had been on strike. Mm-hmm. The professors at the new school. Now, the new school is considered the most liberal college in Manhattan, the most liberal school. But the professors felt that we were not being treated properly, you know, many different bases, not just financial, but several different ways. So we had picket lines, but it's the students who took over the picket lines. And what did they sing? They sang songs that were exactly what I teach in my class for Music and Revolution. They sang the labor songs of Pete Seeger and the Almanac Singers. When I walked to my first step in the picket line, they were singing, "What Side Are You On? What Side Are You On?" which is right from Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie. I believe in the idea of that. I mean, of that perpetual revolution. I'm not the most political of performers myself. I'm not. But, you know, if I can get a message in even in the way that I portray my music or sing it, if I can get a message of love and acceptance and equality, sometimes you can do it with the music itself. But these artists that we're talking about in this book that I wrote about did it with the words and the music. Mm-hmm. And they it's something that needs to not be forgotten, that you can do this in music, and that it now it's not as common. A lot of the popular music now does not have a message. And I think one of my message for, as a writer from this book, is to let younger people know that you can do it. You can use music to further a revolution of equality, of fairness, of love, of maybe it's anti-gun, whatever it is, it's their passion. They can put it into their music if they want to.
That's wonderful. That's a good way to end that interview about your book. I'm wondering what's next and if you have a website where people can reach you and so on.
Oh yeah, people can reach me on all the social media at Richard Barone, but also at my website, richardbarone.com. It's RichardBarone.com. And, you know, you can find the book there. I love to make the book available to people. It's at all the online sellers. It's at Amazon and all those places. It's at all the places where people buy books, but it's also on my website too. Mm-hmm. And you know, people can reach me there and ask questions about it, whatever they like. I'm on all social media as well, if they want me to find me, you know.
And do you have any I know you're a musician as well. You have a record, more than one.
I do have many records. You know, I've made many records, and I've recorded for most record labels at this point. But I started very young. I was signed to RCA Records with the Bongos, was my first band, and I've made a lot of records. But my most recent studio album is the soundtrack to this book. It's called Sorrows and Promises, Greenwich Village in the 1960s. And it has a lot of the music we've been talking about. I just did my version. Phil Oakes, songs by Phil Oakes, by Richard Farina, Richard and Mimi Farina. John Sebastian also sings with me on the album. Or he does plays harmonica on the album. I worked with David Amram, who was there and played with a lot of these musicians. It's a tribute to the era. It's called Sorrows and Promises. And on my website, I offer it as a package with the book and the album on vinyl. It's also streaming, of course, but you can get the vinyl album and the book.
Great, great. Richard Barone, this has just been a wonderful conversation. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Richard Barone, author of Music and Revolution, a history of Greenwich Village and folk music and everything else. Richard, thank you so much for being with us.
And thanks for being such a great interviewer. You have all the right questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Really?
Okay.
Really.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a great interview. Thanks. And
You're
we'll
welcome.
Let you go now.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Thank you.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Sam, and I'd like to thank our special guest tonight, Richard Barone, and all our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/rightonradio. You can listen to all your favorite Right on Radio episodes on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and so on. Please stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.